If I had to choose a favorite animal, well, it changes from day to day, but today it would be the swallow. Like me, these birds call both Europe and Africa home. And I like to think, like me, they see the same world from many perspectives. I left Kenya when I was 10 years old, and I've now lived in the UK for most of my life. What I see here is land that has been worked hard and farmed really hard. The so-called Green Revolution that brought us modern industrial-scale farming and food systems delivers high on calories, but low on nutrients. And the knock-on effects on our health are becoming really hard to ignore, with an explosion of the diseases of affluence, as they're known, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, etc. And that's before I even start banging on about the environment, biodiversity, soil health, and all that good stuff. Meanwhile, the swallow flying back home to my other home in Kenya and in many other parts of Africa. Powerful entities, so from international NGOs to big agri-tech business to billionaire philanthropists, are all pushing this same version of progress of modern industrial farming into African food systems with the promise of ending poverty and hunger in Africa. Sounds like a good thing, right? I know, it should be a good thing. But I can't shake off a little feeling like it's like watching a slow motion train wreck unfolding. Because why keep pushing a food system that has already been proven to be harmful to health, harmful to nutrition, to the environment, and to dignity? And that's not just human dignity, the dignity of the animals that we rear, our livestock. Now, this is a question that was asked by Eddie Muchibi. Eddie is a Ugandan agronomist. He's a social entrepreneur. He's a fifth-generation smallholder farmer, and he's also the president of Slow Food International. This is a global grassroots movement of around 100,000 members committed to producing good, nutrient-dense, healthy food that's affordable and good for the environment and has dignity at its heart. Speaking from his farm in Mukono District, close to the shores of Northern Lake Victoria, Eddie's farming a system known as agroforestry. Now, just picture the scene. Big, lush architectural leaves of cassava, of arrowroot, of yams, growing alongside rainbow maize, millet, and bananas, all under the dappled shade of fruit trees and medicinal trees. The way I've experienced this when I was growing up in Kenya, the whole scene is rich and abundant and alive, with the constant twitch and flicker of birds and butterflies and other wildlife. And it's from farms and scenes like this that smallholder farmers are producing one-third of the world's food while looking after its biodiversity. So while everyone is busy worrying about how Africa is going to feed itself, at least this African farmer and agronomist, Eddie, thinks that industrial farming needs to get its own house in order in ways that might surprise you, because it surprised me too. So I started by asking Eddie about what motivated him, what got him started when he took a look at this juggernaut of industrial farming that was heading his way and thought to himself, I'm going to change this system.
On a personal level, when I was growing up as a child, I spent a lot of time between school and the farm. So always from home to school, from home to the farm. And I saw how my family was doing farming, and this is a real indication of the millions of smallholder farmers who are working on a daily basis to nourish the planet, to feed the people, but also to improve the livelihoods of their households. And I always admired the passion with which my mom used in growing crops. I always admired the knowledge she had on taking care of crops and also managing different aspects on the farm. And I always wanted to support people like her. I wanted to support people who are actually involved in this important activity. That's why I became so disappointed when the school that I went to in my primary school used farming as a punishment if you spoke any other language at school other than English. So whenever you spoke a word in the native language, in the local language, you would be punished, because at school we were only allowed to communicate in English. So we were always punished by sending you under the hot sun to dig, to grow cool food for the teachers and to cultivate the land, something that always annoyed me and angered me, because I'm so much connected to my local language, but also I'm so much connected to farming as a viable option of for many families to find a better livelihood. So using it as a punishment because somebody had to speak a foreign language, to me, was not the right thing. So I always wanted to grow up and make a change. I wanted to support more young people choose to grow food out of their own interest, and also to choose farming as a livelihood activity, not because everything has failed in life that you go back to farming. I wanted always to farm with passion. And that is because passion also drives innovation. So this is how I always wanted to grow up and support and, of course, maintain my job, my main profession as a farmer, but also support other farmers. So I grew up with this passion, and me taking on this role of the president of a food movement that is recognizing the diversity, that is recognizing the importance of small-scale traditional agriculture. For me, it's a part of the call that I had since my childhood to reach out to more people, to encourage more people, but also to share my knowledge, experience, and passion with the same people like me, with the people who want to do better and transform food systems. So for me, of course, it's a challenge, but also it's a very big opportunity to share the motivation, to share the knowledge, but also to guide the food movement towards achieving a good, clean, and fair food system. Because people like my mother, they have worked in a system that is imposing a lot of things on them, a system that is pushing them to adopt the already failing industrial system. When you look at the the structural adjustment programs for many governments here in Africa, they pushed all so much people to adopt large-scale industrial agriculture and ignore and also neglect the struggle of rural women who are managing small plots of land to feed their families and also to find an income to pay school fees for their children. So this system has not been so welcoming to people like my mom, to many women who are struggling. They are not welcoming to the rights of indigenous peoples. And this is why I always found it important that I put a building block to change this system. And me being in this role today is part of the commitment that I made when I was young to put a very big building block to the transformation on the system.
I was just thinking, if only they knew that by angering you as a young boy, this is what they were going to produce. But what I'm interested in is how language can change the way we see the world, right? When you speak in Luganda, how would you describe a lot of these things when you're talking about biodiversity?
The language I grew up speaking is Luganda, but language is part of human ecology. So part of most of the things that we do and how we live, they are also inscribed in our language. So in the central part of Uganda, it's where I come from, where I have my family farm. It's a place which is known to grow many different types of crops on the same piece of land at the same time. So that's why many agricultural scientists describe this place as a banana coffee agroforestry farming system, because agroforestry mm-hmm. carries all the other plants and trees that would not be easily described. But the fact is, in Luganda, we have a direct translation to biodiversity, which is, describes our traditional system.
So what is that word then? Is there one word that would describe biodiversity?
Yeah, there are actually two words that describe our biodiversity or best farming system. It's called Enimaye Chintavuli. So the in real direct translation, it's called like, it's like the farming system of growing many things together. So this is this is because our great grandfathers realized that we live in the tropics, everything is unstable, and also we consider our gardens as a food bank. So you cannot have enough security if you are depending on only one crop. So even that the most dominant crop traditionally grown here in the area where I am is banana. It's mixed with coffee, it's mixed with vanilla, it's mixed with fruit trees to give shade. It's also mixed with wood, like fuel wood trees, also to sustain the household. So this has been there for many, many years, for I can say for thousands of years. And even before the arrival of English as a common language spoken in Uganda, as an official language to describe things, people could describe in the local language how they are growing or which systems they use to grow their crops. And these are the traditional farming systems of the country. And they are, most of them are based on the interrelationships and the benefits they get from having many different crops on the farm.
How does it feel when you're thinking, well, we've got this knowledge, we've got to translate it into from the indigenous language into English and then explain to other people that this works here? Like, what's that process for you and how does that feel?
Many times I get worried because our African traditional farming systems, sometimes they get lost in translation, especially translating from the native or indigenous languages to the foreign languages, and present this unique and traditional farming systems to other people. But the beauty is Slow Food is a grassroots movement that recognizes not only the biodiversity of the plants and animals in the food system, but also the diversity of the people. So this is why I find it very important to work every day at a grassroots level to understand how I can work with the communities, as also partly as a farmer who understand the pain, who understand the challenges, who understand the language and the local area where farmers come from, but also working as a technical person who is an agronomist, who studied agronomy, to make sure that even the local names are recognized, the local food products that are not appearing in many of the scientifically translated materials, they get to be known, and also we preserve not only the biological but also the cultural diversity. We work to preserve this wealth. Not everything that is left out is not important. There are quite a lot of important people who are being excluded in the food system. There are quite a lot of important people who are being day by day eliminated by exclusive policies on land, on seeds, on ownership and control of genetic materials. So sometimes when scientists come and categorize scientifically a product, they want to own it, but this product already has a local name, a traditional name, and many traditions attached to it. So it's our daily struggle as Slow Food to work with communities to bring this to light and also to recognize this diversity that exists.
So I remember So this was before I was even 10 years old. In Nairobi, we would, and I say we, it was my dad actually, would, and myself on a Saturday morning, would leave to go to Nairobi City Market. And we would go once a week to buy most of the food that we'd need for the week. The market would be where farmers would arrive early in the morning in pickup trucks full of vegetables of all descriptions. There were places where you'd buy sacks of rice. You know, we'd also get our fish at the market. Then we'd go to a shopping area just near there where we'd go to a butcher. The guy was called Asif. You know, things like that, I remember such detail, right? Next door was the bakery. We'd get our bread. And by the time we'd do all that, it was lunchtime. I would eat on the way home in the car because I was hungry. And that's how food shopping was for me when I was a kid. And then I remember our first supermarket. It was called Uchumi, the first chain of supermarkets in Kenya. And it was like, we were so impressed. You could buy all these things under one roof. And Uchumi then was taken over. There was Nakumat. That was an even bigger chain of supermarkets. Nowadays, it's Naivas. I don't know what the in Uganda what it is. But how have you seen changes in Uganda? How have you seen, how has that affected you, your family, you as a farmer, your community?
I had never seen a supermarket in my life until 2006, when I moved to start to when I was at the university in Kampala, and I had moved from my home area. I went to the university, and then this is the first time I saw a supermarket. And I lived in Kenya for 3 years, and I used to shop my food in Githurai. I would take a matatu and come to Githurai, buy food from the local market. But then once in a while, I would go to a big supermarket, not to buy food, but to see how and where or what type of food is sold in these supermarkets and where the food is coming from. And I have been doing this in quite many cities where I go. I've been to Ibadan in Nigeria. Many people who change their income, they change, increase their income, they change from buying from the local food markets, and they go and start buying from the supermarkets. And I was wondering what is really pushing them. But I was shocked to learn that most of the food, like vegetables, like dairy products, like animal products, were not actually from within Nigeria. When you go to these big supermarkets, the food sold was from as far as South Africa, was from as far as German, Netherlands, and many other parts of the world. These kind of systems undermine the work of smallholder farmers, the work of local food systems, the work of local economies. Even here in Uganda, you go to large supermarkets, you go to the food section, you find potatoes from France, you find crisps, potato crisps and chips from Malaysia, and yet Uganda and neighboring Kenya are the biggest producers of potatoes in the country. In many cases, it's a very difficult situation because these supermarkets are also born in the food system that pays no respect to the environment, to the climate, the local people, and to the dignity of the producers or the farmers in that local area. However, there are also some good food supermarkets that are focusing on developing local value chains and bringing unique products, and also focusing a lot on setting up a large local organic sections. And some of them are actually working to organize farmers, small farmers in cooperatives, and make sure that they create an opportunity for these farmers. So this is the challenge we still have, but it's still a long way to go. But I totally believe that more advocacy and also more activism for local food systems and bringing more farmers together to understand their role and how important they are in the food system is part of the journey we have to take.
Honestly, there's so much to unpack there, but I just want to go back to what you were saying a little bit earlier, because, you know, I remember again, you know, a lot of the way I frame and try and understand the world the way it looks now is going back to what I remember as a child. And I remember that change when the way people bought their food changed from going to a market where everyone could bring their produce to going to a supermarket that sort of centralized everything. And I remember my mom noticing that the jackfruits would be like, you know, dropping off the tree onto the road and rotting. But people were going to buy apples from South Africa, you know. And she always used to find that crazy, that why are we spending money to go and buy food in a shop when you could just go and pick it? And I think part of that is the kind of, like you sort of hinted at it, this sense of like the local markets are viewed as a place where, I think you used the word low class. Whereas what I can tell you here in the UK, if you want to buy food that's grown in a traditional way, it's considered a luxury. So my question is there any way that you can see a pathway to start fostering more value for traditional foods? How can we sort of break this kind of almost like invisible trap of seeing progress as, right, well, I'll be buying my food in a supermarket from now on because I've made more money and I'm going places in life?
It's important. Also, looking at my experience working in many African countries, I realized that there is a big paradox that exists between the consumption patterns in the global north and the global south. So talking about Africa here, even in my home country, in Kenya, in Nigeria, in Ghana, in many countries in Africa where I've been, there is a lot of consumption of junk food among people whose income tremendously increased. There is a relationship between, a positive relationship between the increase in income and the consumption of unhealthy foods.
So this is the ultra-processed food.
Ultra-processed foods, mm-hmm. And also less nutritious food. In I'll give you an example. In Uganda here, the big fast food chains, they advertise as restaurants for high-class people. So many times when young person's income, I say young person because 78% of the Ugandan population is below the age of 40. So the largest population is basically young, and the unhealthy consumption food businesses, they're actually targeting this population. So whenever there is an increase in income of a person, they feel like it's time to abandon the local food and go for the exotic fried chicken, chips, and go for dairy products like yogurt, cheese, and milk that is imported from Netherlands. And they believe that this is the food that is like the food from highly industrialized systems. They think that this is the food that matches their class because it is marketed like that. They feel like it's only high class people who will go to buy food from the supermarket. And when they reach the supermarket, they will check if these potatoes are from Kabale, which is southwestern Uganda, and the other section, there are potatoes from Nice, from France, they will go for the potatoes from very far away, not even caring if they are loaded with agrochemicals or they have been preserved for so long. Another case is in rice consumption. There is a lot of highly aromatic rice produced by smallholder farmers in Uganda. But again, whenever families' incomes increase, they will look out for basmati rice from Pakistan, from India. They will look out for rice from Vietnam that has spent months and months on the ship, being fumigated, being preserved such that the grains will reach Uganda in a good shape. So this is a question of education. This is a question of raising awareness. That is why the cases of overweight and obesity are common among rich and affluent Africans. Unlike in the global north, where the cases of overweight and obesity are among those people who are not economically fortunate enough to purchase high quality, well-balanced and nutritious organic food. So here it's the total opposite. This is a question of attitude. It's a question of education. It's a question of people learning to unlearn what the media, what the persuasive advertisement from the large food corporates are teaching. It's also in the case of in production. the fertilizer and the chemical industries are advertising and say, if you want to be a modern farmer and be recognized by the government as a modern farmer, you should use these chemical products. You should adopt the high-yielding hybrids, which come with a long list of agrochemicals. So that is why we see a steady growth in the use of agrochemicals, in the use of antibiotics. Also, when you look at the government programs, the direct foreign investments, the corporates, the large industrial firms, they want to invest in Africa, and they convince the governments and say, if you want to modernize your agricultural system, embrace the industrial production system like that is found in Europe. We need also not only to educate the consumers, but also to educate the policymakers, to educate the legislators, to understand that this is a recipe for disaster. First for the public health system in Uganda, in terms of obesity, overweight, and diseases that are associated to food that our economy cannot easily manage, but also in terms of the environmental disaster that is waiting for us. So many, many forests are being cut down to produce more and more sugar because there is a very big increase in the consumption of sugary foodstuffs, and many companies are now opening up to produce fizzy drinks, to produce sugar-loaded food products. So the demand for sugar is really high. And now we see the forest coverage in Uganda, in many other areas, it's shrinking because we need to expand the sugar production. That is what the government is trying to do. But it's a question of education. It's a question of advocacy. It's a question of raising awareness.
Most of us have woken up to the idea that where and how we spend our money can be our loudest vote. But what about where we keep our money, who we bank with? According to the Consumer Association, UK high street banks are amongst the worst culprits when it comes to financing fossil fuels, arms companies, and all the stuff we don't think of when we talk about positive change. Triodos Bank has been blazing a trail for the financial sector in ethical and sustainable banking for over 40 years. With almost 750,000 customers, it looks like there are a lot of people out there who want to know that their money is not propping up all the wrong things and instead supporting all the right things. Named eco provider by Which, Triodos refuses to lend to fossil fuel projects, focusing instead on renewable energy, nature regeneration, and community projects. Triodos' aim is simple: to be a safe and secure bank for your money, while being totally transparent with what they do with your money. I honestly could not be happier to have them as a sponsor of If I Rule the World. I mean, it's crazy when you talk about sugar production, because in the meantime, here, they're introducing sugar taxes. They're trying to think of ways to get people to have less sugar because of the health implications, yet the production is ramping up. What I wanted to ask you as well was, there's some very vocal farmers. There's one Kenyan farmer in particular that is quite vocal on social media and gets a lot of press in on some platforms at least, where the argument is almost the exact opposite of what you're advocating for, which is by preventing the adoption of industrial scale farming, of the use of fertilizers, the two things that are going to happen on the African continent. One is Africa won't be able to feed itself. And two is it will never see the prosperity. People will never live in the kind of comfort that they see in the global north. What would you say to that?
That's quite ridiculous, but expected, because a country like Kenya has accepted to be the testing ground for all the policies and work of the corporates in agriculture. And it's very unfortunate to hear this, especially for the neighboring countries. But the fact remains the industrial system is not meant for Africa. The power of Africa to feed itself is in biodiversity. The one-size-fits-all monocultural system even breeds more and more problems to the African environment. Right now, there is a maize crisis in East Africa. And nobody is saying that this maize crisis is as a result of the failure of the DK maize variety that is being traded all over East Africa, and it's from Kenya. So that is why Kenya is actually has been struggling with hunger, because this variety is failing, and also the companies have failed to release another variety on time. So nobody is talking about this, but those who are, I grow all the corn that my family needs, all the corn we sell, all the maize we sell from the traditional rainbow varieties. And many farmers are now in Uganda adopting these traditional varieties. They may not be as high yielding as the new varieties, but they do not need even to spray against the fall armyworm. They do not need chemicals. They do not need a lot of nutrients. They need to be planted with compost, with organic matter, to give you a very good yield. Mm-hmm. So in it, creating a dependency of African farmers on foreign and highly controlled inputs is no way going to feed Africa. The power to feed Africa is in the hands of African smallholder farmers, protecting and preserving the diversity. That is the definition of agricultural productivity in Africa. While the Green Revolution defined productivity by the quantity of a single crop yield that you get from the piece of land, the productivity of African agriculture is in on the number of species that you have per square unit of land. That is the security African farmers have. We've seen African communities happily feeding themselves and putting food on the market locally to exchange and sell without any of these inputs. But the arrival of these inputs have created more loss of biodiversity, the increase in use of herbicides on coffee farms, on banana farms, on rice farms and corn farms in Africa have led to a disaster in nutrition, because these herbicides are not only targeting the dangerous weeds, but also the vegetables African families forage and feed on to supplement their nutrient needs. So, yeah, there is a difference between high production and you record high yields, but this is different from nourishing the communities and nourishing the people of Africa.
You're the president of Slow Food International. How do you see the struggle or this work, this advocacy work in other continents and other parts of the world, even in Europe? Like, how do you see that evolving?
We can no longer accept as farmers boardroom decisions which are made without the presence of smallholder farmers. But in many cases, when decisions on agriculture are being done, they are done between the agribusiness corporations and the farmers and the companies they support, together with the government. In many cases, they ignore the voice of the farmers. Then we work together with the local governments to work out policies and also implement those policies which have been drafted, but they are lying idle in the shelves. Sometimes it's a deliberate effort by the governments to frustrate good policies and adopt terrible policies. The Crops Act in Kenya, like the Seed Act in Uganda, there are some clauses which actually criminalize local seed systems and pushing farmers to adopt industrialized seed systems, only to be more and more neo-colonialistic and extractive. So these are some of the policies we want to see reviewed, but we always want to see the input of the farmers who are saving local seed biodiversity incorporated into these laws and policies. Many policies in the global north, many laws, regulations in the global north directly affect communities of farmers and how Africa feeds itself and other people in the global south. So we need to find the synergy here. One example is when there is a ban on agrochemicals, there are quite a number of agrochemicals which have been banned in the European Union. And these chemicals, because they can no longer find the market, once a policy or a law is passed in the EU to ban specific agrochemicals, and they can no longer find the market there because of their danger to environment and human health, they find their way to on the African market. You find a lot of them pushed and exported to Africa. Kenya itself is struggling with this problem of the banned, of the highly hazardous agrochemicals banned in Europe And now they are flocking and filling up the shelves on the Kenyan market. The list has been published recently because Kenyan people are now concerned. After opening up to highly industrialized agriculture, such things start to happen.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so Eddie, I'm watching you talk. You're so focused and so, you know, I can hear and sense this determination. On your farm, is there an animal or a tree or, you know, a particular habitat that you find joyful?
Yeah, quite many, but the most joyful tree that I love so much is the tree of the African Eleni. The indigenous name is Mpafu.
Mpafu.
Yeah, it's also...
And why this tree?
When we were young, I remember we could go to work on the farm, but when you get these like olives, the fruits are like olives, mm-hmm. we would put them in the, like put two olives on in one in each of the cheeks, and then you go to work on the farm, maybe picking coffee or picking beans or planting beans. But by the time you finish working, you don't talk. When you put these two fruits in the mouth, you don't talk. But by the time you finish working, they are very, very soft and they are well cooked. So you eat and throw out the stone and then you put two more. So it was always fun. And I still do that also with my children when we go to the farm. So I love it so much.
Those are your favorites. Thank you. And last question, if you rule the world, Eddie, what would you do?
If I rule the world, I would stop the destructive industrial and the highly limiting industrial systems. Like in livestock, it's unethical to keep animals in such intensive way. It's unethical to mistreat animals while raising them. And also it's dangerous for the planet to raise animals in that way. So if I ruled the world, I would declare industrial livestock systems, highly intensive industrial systems, illegal.
Thank you so much. Enima Yechintabuli. The farming system of growing many things together. Maybe this is the closest English can get to describing how farming can encourage biodiversity as well as meeting human needs. And maybe this is a glimpse to how indigenous knowledge, culture, language, all of that can capture ecological fluency. My biggest takeaway, though, was that if Eddie ruled the world, it wouldn't be about supercharging productivity in farming, increasing yields and making more and more food, the stuff of empty calories devoid of nutrients. It would be about making better food, grown and reared with respect, ethics and dignity, especially for livestock and animal welfare at its heart. I think it's really telling that above all else, this was his concern, that it takes a farmer from Uganda to hold up a mirror to industrial food systems. There was so much more we touched upon in that conversation, and it made me think about how, in wanting to do this podcast series, I wanted to set out to shine a light on the invisible barriers to positive change, as I call them. Well, this episode revealed an uncomfortable one. Me. Now, I don't fully understand why, but I found myself stopping short of digging deeper into how the reach of big corporations, of powerful entities, of individuals who have accumulated such wealth and influence can make decisions about us without us. This is something that reaches way beyond Africa and food and farming systems and affects every single one of us everywhere. So whether it's the NHS, whether it's the green energy transition, whether it's the colonization of the night sky by more and more satellites that may mean soon, we and certainly future generations may never be able to have a clear view of the stars ever again. These are just some of the conversations I've got lined up for future podcasts. If you've got any suggestions or burning questions or comments, I'd love to hear from you. Spotify has a Q&A function that you can use to join the conversation, or you can just email me at podcast@jillianburkevoice.com. For now, though, this is the last podcast before Christmas, so I wanted to take this opportunity to wish you a happy festive season, however you celebrate that. I also want to say thank you to my sponsors, Triodos Bank UK, for helping me begin this journey. And last, but by no means least, a huge, massive thank you to all of you for listening and embarking on this journey with me. I appreciate all the follows, the subscribers, the likes, the comments, the emails. I haven't pushed this podcast very hard on social media. It's not one of my favorite places. But even so, this podcast has charted among the top science podcasts on Spotify and Apple, and we have only just begun. The next episode is out on December 29th. It's the last one for this year, 2023. And I'll be speaking to two extraordinary young conservationists where we really challenge and encourage each other to call out more of those invisible barriers, mindset and systemic barriers to positive change. For now, though, take a breath, take a moment to ask yourself, if you rule the world, what would you do?